I'd like to open the February 20th, 2012 session of the House Committee on Veterans Affairs. Because of posting requirements, we're going to be holding informational hearings this morning on the various bills. And the first one I'm going to open an informational hearing on is Senate Bill 1563. Chana?
Good morning, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Chana Newell. Senate Bill 1563 comes to you from the Senate Veteran and Militaries Affairs Committee. It passed out with a unanimous vote. It aligns the state definition of veteran with the federal definition of veteran by extending certain state law protections and benefits already available to military service personnel to members of the Commissioned Corps of the National Atmospheric and Oceanic Administration and the United States Public Health Service. An amendment was added to the original bill that requires community colleges to waive tuition for children and surviving spouses of service members who died as a result of military service-connected disabilities. We have received the fiscal and revenue impact statements, and there is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. There is a fiscal note associated with SB 1563.
No fiscal impact.
Excuse me, that is incorrect. There is a fiscal impact.
Okay. Thank you.
So there'd have to be.
I think.
I was going to say, yes. Thank you very much. All right. And with that, I'd like to call up, please, Robert Thornhill.
You don't have it yet.
Good morning and welcome back to our committee.
Thank you for having me back. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Thornhill. I appear before you in support of SB 1563. In doing so, it's my honor and privilege to speak for members of VFW Post 1442. I've submitted written testimony. I do not propose to repeat that testimony here, but with your permission, I'd like to say a few words about Oregon's tuition waiver program. Next to fallen and severely disabled soldiers themselves, no one is given more in America's war than their children and spouses. In recognition of this fact, in 2008, the Oregon legislature enacted what is commonly referred to as the tuition waiver program. This gift from the people of Oregon will not bring back or make whole their loved ones. It will, however, give the intended recipients a chance at an education they may not otherwise be able to obtain. OUS Chancellor Pernsteiner supported the legislation establishing this program. Thank you. I'm not sure that's going to help, but thank you very much.
Mr. Thornhill, she doesn't do that for us, so feel very privileged.
Jane, I do feel privileged.
We're on our own.
Chancellor Pernsteiner supported this legislation establishment program, and under his leadership, it has been successfully implemented by Oregon universities. Several recipients have received or are receiving a college education they might not otherwise attain. They're better off for it, as is Oregon and America. The program has not bankrupted OUS, and I suggest you will not find OUS student recipients living in luxury or bilking the taxpayers. As you're aware, extensive efforts have been made, with only limited success, to coax community college to implement tuition waiver programs in line with the statutes and with the OUS program. The last effort, Senate Bill 338, also failed. While the task force clearly understood and accepted the mandate of SB 338, as shown in my written testimony and by the task force report itself, the task force elected to disregard that mandate. I call that disregard contempt for the law and for this legislature. Attached to the task force's 1 February report is a spreadsheet headed Veterans, Spouses, and Dependents Tuition Waiver. Presumably, this is to show that the task force complied with SB 338 and that all 17 community colleges have established tuition waiver programs. If that is the intent, it's an absurdity. 15 of the listed colleges apply the so-called federal state aid applied first method, which you will find the task force spent much time quibbling about, first dollar, last dollar, so on. But clearly, the colleges, 14 of those colleges, do not even come near to having a policy in line with the statutes or with the policy of OUS. It is disingenuous to even apply that they do. Two colleges on the list have established waiver policies in line with the statutes and with OUS policy. They are Chemetka and Umpqua. The spreadsheet is incorrect with respect to Blue Mountain and Portland. The spreadsheet shows them applying federal state aid applied first. The website of those colleges show otherwise. Blue Mountain Scholarship Program is closely aligned with the statute. A copy of the scholarship program is attached to my written testimony. Portland applies federal aid and scholarships first. However, as I understand the Portland policy, as described on its website, an eligible student may receive both the waiver and the VADA benefits, which are required to pay for a college education, and which is in line with the Oregon statutes and OUS policy. If these four community colleges understand the statutes and comply, there's no legitimate reason why the other 13 cannot. Just do it. It's easy. Don't collect tuition from eligible students. For a variety of reasons, many students prefer to at least start their post-secondary education at the community college level. The students involved in this program should be given that option. Oregon needs the graduates of both the four-year college as well as the community college. As explained in my written testimony, Gunnery Sergeant John D. Fry Scholarship has reduced significantly the number of students for the waiver program. However, the remaining eligible should have the option for community college. And obviously, a community college education is less expensive than a university. Since it is clear, however, that most community colleges and associations will not voluntarily adopt waiver programs in line with the statutes, it is requested this committee approve SB 1563, giving consideration to the amendments proposed in my written testimony. Before I leave this chair, my comrade back at 1442 directed me to thank you for what you do here in Salem, not only for veterans and their families, but for all Oregonians. And on their behalf, I thank you and your staff also. With that, I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'll be pleased to try to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Questions or comments for Mr. Thornhill? Robert, I want to ask you a question that I don't at all expect you to necessarily know the answer to, but in the event that you do, it would be helpful. Do you know why this bill was written to only include community colleges and not our state universities? And again, as I say, I don't expect
you... Well, universities are already in the program of basic legislation.
Okay.
That basic legislation was Senate Bill 1066, Section 9. Now codified at Oregon Revised Statute 351.656.
Mm-hmm.
And all these many years we've been having this conversation about getting a community college to sign up.
Okay. All right.
And... So this is just one last effort.
Very good.
I hope not the last one. But, I do hope it is the last one. I hope we can get it done.
Thank you. Anything further? Not seeing anything, Robert. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate
thank you very much, all of you. Yeah.
Your continued support for our state's veterans. Next, I'd like to call up, please, John Wyckoff and Krissa Caldwell.
Oh, yeah.
And anyone else that you might choose to have come up if there is anyone else. Good morning and welcome back to our committee. In some sense, this is deja vu all over again. So.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association. And with me today is Krissa Caldwell, deputy director for Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. And as you remember, we were here, I believe, last week talking about the task force from Senate Bill 338. And I just want to very quickly clarify what the charge of that report was. That report asked the college presidents in consultation with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to look at what it would take to align our tuition waiver program with the Oregon University System tuition waiver program, and to report on what it would take to do so,
yes.
And then to provide recommendations on what the president's thought was the best policy to move forward. And as you'll remember from last week, we did provide that report and did talk about what it would take. The main difference remaining is the first dollar and last dollar approaches of the Oregon University System and us. As you may remember last week, Bridget Burns from the University System testified that they also don't believe that it necessarily makes sense to have the programs be exactly the same, as we have different cost structures and in several ways, such as financial aid, where a community college student will get a smaller award than a university student to reflect those different cost structures. She asked me to remind you again today that was the sort of their perspective, that there wasn't necessarily a reason to have these programs be mirror images of each other. But I want to talk quickly about what these amendments do, and then we would have, should the committee decide to move forward with this amendment, we would have one change that we would ask to make, because I think it goes a bit further than was the intention. Again, if the committee should move forward with this concept. But let me quickly just sort of talk about what this does. The original version of the tuition waiver program would have exempted tuition for spouses and dependents of members of the military that were killed in action, had become 100% disabled based on Department of Defense criteria, or were killed, died later as a result of their disability. What this amendment does is provides a waiver only for those who were spouse and dependents of soldiers who were killed in action or died as a result of 100% disability, which is different than died as a result of disability. It's just for those that would die as a result of 100% disability. It's a smaller, much smaller group, we think. And so what it does is it makes it a smaller, much, much smaller eligibility pool for the colleges who are operating on very tight margins. Beside the fact that we believe in the first dollar approach, we believe it's appropriate to look at all of the resources on the table, federal, state, and local, and look at what is the appropriate package to make sure that a student can go to school. And as you remember, we said, we have basically been applying this program as a safety net program, so that if somebody falls through the cracks of other available aid and can't attend college because they don't have other aid available, then the waiver kicks in. And so that's how we've been applying it. So we believe first that is the right way to do it. If it were a full-blown waiver for us, the largest group by far is that 100% disabled. That's about 6,000 families in Oregon. Now, obviously, determining how many folks from those families, whether it be spouse or dependent, would go to school is difficult, but it's the largest part of that which this bill exempts. What it does is it gets you down to about 132 eligible families right now. And within that, the approach is a bit bifurcated about who would get first dollar or last dollar. And this is one of our concerns with this approach, is it applies as first dollar a scholarship called the Gunnery Sergeant John D. Fry Scholarship. It's a federal entitlement program that only dependents are eligible for, not spouses. So if you were a dependent with that scholarship, excuse me, that would be applied first dollar before the tuition waiver. If you were a spouse, you don't have access to that scholarship, and so in that case, it would always be applied, the waiver would always be applied for first dollar. I think our concern there is that, you know, we've been criticized that we have a program with different eligibilities and that it's confusing, and the colleges have tried to bring that all online, and this puts into statute sort of two different standards, where some folks would have it applied first dollar, which we think is appropriate in many cases, and for some folks there would never be aid applied first dollar. So it sort of takes out one piece of federal aid and said that should be first dollar, but for this group nothing should be applied first dollar. And I think that creates further confusion. So that would be a concern we would have.
We could take a question just for a moment. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, John, if you don't mind, and I know you got to make the point about, you know, you don't need an influx of folks moving into Oregon, you know, and maybe the Oregon vet aspect of it. But I've sat through a lot of testimony on 338 and, you know, last year and on and on. Do you have a list? Has somebody, the veterans community, campus veteran services officer, county veteran services officers, family members themselves. Do you have a list? Because I have never seen a list of the potential students that are not getting an education because they've been denied because of what community colleges or anybody else is doing. I try to focus the efforts, my efforts within this building, I'm not speaking for anybody else at the dais, but I'm here to fix problems. So how many people are on this list that have been denied education? What are we trying to fix? Is there a long list? Have you been provided? Because campus, when we had campus officers and county services officers, nobody has provided me a list of these folks that we're trying to get into the educational arena. And I welcome anybody else up here. If you know that there are 100 people or a handful, I don't know. I've never heard of anybody that's been denied education.
I think that's the critical question, Representative Huffman. Thank you.
Chair Witt, Representative Huffman. I mean, the short answer is no, I haven't. I mean, I have not seen a list of like that, that when we don't have knowledge of that happening. I mean, I don't know that it hasn't, but I don't have any proof that it has. And I think that was part of the reason for, well, that what our approach does is to try to make sure that doesn't happen, to say we couldn't afford a full-blown waiver. We didn't have the resources to do this for all of those groups. But what we wanted to make sure was that all of these spouses and dependents understood that you will get to go to college from one source or another, and that if the federal programs that are already available, there are at least two entitlement programs that we now know of, that if those don't work and get you into school, the colleges will make sure you do. And so that the approach is made so that you don't end up with a list like that. But no, from ODVA or anyone else, I have not. We don't have any specific examples of folks not being able to attend because they, I guess what you're asking is, did not receive a waiver because they had other sources of aid, or didn't receive other sources of aid. Because in theory, or not even in theory, in practice, if they don't receive other sources of aid, that's when the waiver kicks in, and that's what it's intended to do.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would it be appropriate for me to ask at the dais, does anybody know of a list or that anybody's been denied education? Okay.
But you got just slightly ahead of me to the other issue that we did want to flag for the committee, that were this approach the committee wanted to move forward with. Under the current draft, it would allow anybody who was killed in action to use this waiver, and our concern there would be, and it makes the fiscal that you have in front of you was based off simply Oregon residents, so folks who were deployed from Oregon. In the current wording of the legislation, it would be for any KIA in the United States could come to Oregon, and when they move into our districts, which only you get residency within 3 months of living in the district, you could then, for the purposes of this legislation, become basically an Oregon resident. So determining the fiscal is very difficult. We based it off just Oregon residents, or Community College and Workforce Development based it off just Oregon residents, but it would, again, be a larger number because you could move here. And I think we would ask that should the committee move forward with this approach, that it be specified that it's for soldiers who were deployed from Oregon, so that it would be meant for Oregon residents, because it would be, you know, you're dealing with larger numbers. Krista can speak to this. They did look up the numbers from border states, and it's about 850 eligible families from border states. And again, I mean, that's a very imperfect way to do that. It's very difficult when you have the eligibility open to basically the entire United States. So that would be a concern, and should we move forward, I think we'd like to have that, we would hope to have that tightened up so that it's clear that it's really a program for Oregon residents. And I think with that, I will close again. With this approach, it is not so much the financial issue, because with the larger program, if we were supposed to not look at any of the federal money on the table, that would be financially difficult for the colleges. Obviously less so here because the numbers are much smaller, but I think this doesn't, to the degree that the concern was, we wanted a program that was consistent and that applied the same way to all students. we don't think that, that this meets that test, that this may go in the opposite direction of creating sort of a more confusing system.
All right, thank you very much. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, John, you said something that kind of caught my attention there when you talked about 100% disabled according to the military, and I'm just wondering what that is, because I would feel terrible if somebody who had one leg missing wasn't afforded an equal opportunity to go to school because they didn't have two legs missing. And I'm just saying that. I don't know what 100% disabled means. But and that would, it's kind of like when we get the calls, and this, you wouldn't know about this probably, but some of our constituents call us and say, I'm really stuck now. I make $6 too much per month to get this service, and so what do? I quit my job so that I can get the services and things like that. And, you know, they were just right up to the edge. And that's kind of my question is, what does that mean?
Chair Witt, Representative Booth, let me attempt to answer that, because I won't pretend to be expert in how, but I do know the way that it's calculated is it's more sort of stacked per injury. So it's you know, a certain injury will get you 20%, and then another one will get you another percent, and they sort of stack them until you get to 100. And what my folks on my board who are veterans tell me is getting to the last 100 is quite difficult. That they do when once you get to that 100, you get access to quite a few more benefits. So they are more sparing about who gets to 100%. But I think the reason, to get directly to your question, the reason for cutting off the eligibility to just 100% disabled folks who had died as a result of 100% disability and from folks who were 100% disabled, or it sounds like from what you're asking even somewhat less, was simply about numbers. It was less of a policy, I think, discussion and more of a financial. It's easier to ask for this because you're talking about fewer people. But this was not our amendment, so it was not our approach.
Okay. Thank you.
Co-Chair Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's very difficult to determine the percentage of disability. Example, I have a 20% disability from Agent Orange. I have diabetes from it. But actually, I'm going to die from that. So when do I go to 30%? When do I go to 40%? It's a crapshoot at best, you know. Whereas with someone that's missing legs, arms, or paralyzed, it's pretty easy to figure that one out. But some of these things are very, very difficult to determine.
And Mr. Chair?
Please.
Then who makes that determination?
The VA.
The VA? Okay, thank you. So, Andy, I think I'm the only person up here who's not a veteran. So.
No, I'm just.
Well, you have one in the family.
Yes.
So. She's been married to the.
Vicariously.
John, as I'm looking at who's covered, you were talking about tuition waivers for dependents of deceased veterans as well as those who are 100% disabled. Among those two categories, is there anyone who would not be receiving benefits if the first dollar were federal benefits?
I think there may be some narrow instances, and I have to Chair Witt, and I'm not. I'm not sure what exactly they are, but I know in conversations with ODVA, they did have concerns that with the DEA program, there might have been some narrower eligibility than mm-hmm. in our case than with what the tuition waiver program offers here. Though if that were the case, the tuition waiver would kick in.
Yes,
because they wouldn't if they weren't eligible. And I don't know. I can't give you a clear definition of what those differences. I don't know the DEA program obviously as well as I know ours. But again, if somebody did not meet the criteria of one of those other federal benefits, then our waiver program would kick in.
And last week we had discussion, excuse me, about those instances possibly when federal benefits might be slow in flowing to the beneficiaries, and I'm wondering You accommodated those instances last week. Could you describe your approach with respect to dependents of deceased or 100% disabled?
Sure. Chair Witt, the colleges, the presidents in our task force meeting, one of the issues that came up as one of the most important issues, that if folks are waiting for benefits, we want to make sure that they're not waiting around and not attending college because they're waiting to find out if benefits come in. And so that if they receive benefits down the road, they could be applied back to tuition. And if they don't, then their tuition will be waived. We will also be sort of coming out of the hearing that we had last week in our President's Council, Oregon President's Council meeting that is happening later this week. We'll be discussing both that to make sure all the colleges have the right approach for that and the issue of textbook vouchers for colleges who own their own bookstores. And this is something that came up in the hearing last week where colleges who own their own bookstores especially have the ability to provide vouchers so that students can pay for their textbooks while they're waiting for their benefits to come in because, as you know, textbooks are an extremely high cost, or one of the higher costs within higher education, often, you know, ranging from $300 to $600 a term. I mean, it's one of the big expenses within higher education. So we will be talking this Thursday, I believe, at our President's Council meeting about how to expand that approach to as many campuses where it's feasible. It's harder if you don't have a bookstore, obviously. But so we'll be looking at ways to make sure that, to the degree that there are remaining cracks, we fill them.
Okay. And just for the record, very specifically, what you have just responded to me to on my questions applies to dependents of those who have been killed and those who dependents of those who are 100% disabled.
And yeah, Chair Witt, yes, and those who die as a result of disability, not necessarily 100% disability, just die as a result of disability, period.
Right. Thank you very much. Additional questions or comments? Not seeing any. Thank you both very, very much. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify at this time on Senate Bill 1563? General Caldwell, please.
Mr. Chair, may I ask a question of my fellow representative? We think we passed legislation that opened up ODVA home loans to anyone that enters in the state of Oregon. It used to be where it was you had to enter the service in the state of Oregon and or reside here for a five-year period. I don't believe we changed that, did we? I know we changed it for tuition, for in-state tuition for veterans.
Mr. Chair, I was thinking it had been Oregon veteran, and I was thinking we had maybe in 2009 opened that up to where you didn't have to be an Oregon veteran. You didn't have to enter from Oregon to qualify. Could be wrong, but that's
fine.
Yes.
Well, but before we engage in a lot of speculation, we will check with ODVA on that, and they can probably direct us to the appropriate site in Oregon statute. With that, good morning, General Caldwell.
Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. Not here to lobby one way or the other on the bill, but I think there's some terms that I've been hearing tossed around that need probably clarification if you go ahead and move this.
Thank you.
There's a lot of discussion about killed in action. This bill doesn't require that. It basically says, the amendment says that if the person died on active duty.
Yes.
So they might even look for clarification on active duty because there's federal active duty, Title 10, and there's also active duty in Title 32 for the National Guard. So you've got terms that are widely kind of disseminated as if everybody knows them, but I'm not so sure that when the law is written and people start opening the books and seeing what they have to do, they're going to come to different conclusions. So I'd highly recommend you clarify that. If it was certainly within your power to do that, I would certainly clarify it. Otherwise, I think you may open up a bigger body of folks than what you think you're doing. Other than that, like I said, I don't have an opinion one way or the other on the bill. I just think that you need to be careful about the terms.
Thank you very much. Absolutely. Otherwise, we won't know who's covered and who isn't. So thank you for calling that to our attention. I'm just wondering, I think I asked you last week, and if I didn't, I'm going to ask today anyways. Are you aware of anyone who has complained that they have not received tuition payments because they were either receiving federal benefits as opposed to state or vice versa?
Mr. Chairman, one of the testimonies for this committee, I think I gave the number around 70% of our soldiers that are returning veterans and are going to school or going to community colleges. Our relationship with the community colleges has been nothing short of outstanding. There's been delays in many instances of how they get their funds from the VA. Some of those funds come through the National Guard Bureau for other tuition waivers that we have. And they've always been accommodating to our folks. I have never heard of a single solitary issue where somebody was maligned by a community college or put in a financial trap of any sort. They've been very accommodating and worked very hard to assist our folks. And I think that's why most of our folks are going to community colleges. One is cheaper. They don't get full benefit typically because they've only been on active duty for a year. So they get one-third of the federal benefit. Also, we have issues sometimes with funding at the national level where our monies are delayed for tuition assistance that are coming through. So our education officer works with those colleges, and they've been extremely accommodating. To my knowledge, they've never charged us any interest or anything of the sort, certainly not the soldiers. So our relationship's very good.
Thank you very much. Anything additional for General Caldwell? Seeing nothing, thank you very much. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify on Senate Bill 1563 this morning? Seeing none, I'm going to close the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1563, and I'm going to open, as soon as I can find my informational hearing on Senate Bill 1561.
Good morning, committee. Senate Bill 1561 comes to you from the Senate Veterans and Military Affairs Committee. It modifies the Homeland Security Council structure and aligns it with H.J.R. 7 from 2011 session if it is approved by the voters. It also has a -1 amendment which requires the Oregon Military Department to provide the legislative fiscal officer and committee or interim committee relating to the military with copies of any cooperative agreement within 10 days of the Oregon Military Department entering into such agreement with the federal government. The original bill has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. We've received the revenue impact for the -1 amendments, and there is no revenue impact, and we are still waiting for the fiscal impact on the -1s.
Thank you. And we're still waiting for someone to indicate that they want to testify in the bill. Is there anyone in the room this morning who would care to testify on Senate Bill 61? Senate Bill 1561. Not seeing anyone. Is there any
out there?
Any discussion? Yes.
I just have a quick question.
Boone.
This bill refers to House Joint Resolution 7, which will be decided by voters this November. And Chana, do you know or anything more about that?
Yes, that bill, Brett Boone, that bill related to emergencies and natural disasters, and it would allow, I believe, two-thirds of the assembly to be present in a remote location and to participate by electronic communication should there be some form of natural disaster or health emergency.
Okay, thank you. And I was thinking that was it, but, you know, and thank you for that clarification.
You're welcome.
Chana, do you, not to put you on the spot, but do we have any information from other states as to how they handle these kinds of emergencies?
Co-Chair Witt, I do not have that, but I can find that out for you.
I think General Caldwell would like to.
General Caldwell.
He's walking this way, so I'm assuming he's not leaving.
He knows a few things about emergencies.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director of Military Department and Interim Head of OEM, Office of Emergency Management. This bill was actually, I think, introduced for the purpose of trying to make the Homeland Security Council a little more nimble, to give it less girth in With respect to the membership, I think there was something on the order of 25, 30 members on it before. Certainly, we don't have a necessarily a negative opinion in having all those folks together, but what we found during the period of time that we've been doing this for the last several years is that most generally they didn't attend very often. There was kind of a core group that did. And I think the idea here was to try to get the core group together more often, use the other members that used to be sitting on the council by gubernatorial appointment and by statute, and use that more as a invite-in for certain subcommittee activity. But this group would be the primary group. With respect to the earlier question, I'm not familiar with other states with respect to the constitutional amendment. The idea behind that, however, was that in the event that, because we have other statutory language that requires the legislature to be to do certain things during a catastrophic emergency, and I think we're all thinking about the Cascadia, for instance.
Yes.
The Cascadia fault. Predictions would be up to 8 point, beyond 8 point on the coast, and then somewhere here in the valley. So it's feasible to assume that you you probably won't have communications, you probably will not have transportation routes, and at a certain point in post-event, you're going to need to be able to get legislative approval of some sort to spend money, for instance, and to do other things for the recovery and for the, not necessarily the recovery, but for the emergency itself, then the recovery. So I think that's the idea behind the constitutional amendment, is to allow you all to actually be in the game and not divert everything over to the executive. Certainly, there's pros and cons to that argument, but at some point there has to be, finances have to be approved, money has to flow, certain things got to happen. You're currently, the Constitution says you got to meet here in Salem, you got to have a quorum, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you may not be able to do that. You may not be able to get people from the coast. You may not be able to get people up and down I-5. Predictions are that every single overpass on I-5, north to south, with that kind of a shake, is probably going to make I-5 impassable. So that's just a simple example. Bridges would have to be inspected. It's going to take weeks to get bridges even certified that you can drive over them again in an earthquake of that magnitude. So I think that's kind of the focus where that constitutional amendment came from. You probably recall it toward the waning days of the last session, where there was a lot of discussion about this particular item. And I think some people were, you know, either not sure about it, or certainly had questions that whether or not they wanted to move that direction. Personally, I think it's a choice of you, your body, the legislative body. Certainly, I think it puts you in the game in a big way. If you have that ability, if the people give you that ability, you could phone in to your district or in Southern Oregon, and you could actually be a participant in major decisions, as opposed to now, you got to find your way to Salem and get in this building. This building may not be here. So I think that was the idea behind that. I know other states have other mechanisms to try to do that, to keep their legislature together. I don't know that this was ever copied off any single state, though.
Very good. Thank you. That's very helpful. Anything further for the general? Thanks very much. You're appreciate welcome. That. Last and final call on Senate Bill 1561. Anyone from the public? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the informational hearing on Senate Bill 1561. And I am going to open.
Nope. I don't have anything else.
We're done with our business this morning. We're a fast group.
We are.
Anything for the good of the order?
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I could always remind you, those of you who were not here in 2005 when we had the joint committee on emergency preparedness, and a bill that was brought forward, I think, in 2005 and 2007, Brigadier General might remember it, to give the governor authority to do some things. And it was highly debatable and got into the discussion of who was the governor at the time and did you want to let that person have these authorities. And, you know, with all due respect to people's partisan predilections or whatever you call them, I thought at the time and still think that, you know, when something big like that happens, I don't think we're going to care who is in that seat. We're just going to need stuff to happen. And part of that step is doing this action that we're talking about just briefly before. And I think it's going to be so shocking what the status of the state will be that we can't even imagine it now. I mean, go rent those movies that they have that I love to watch late at night, you know, like 2012 or whatever, where the big wave comes over and you know they're making it in a fish tank, but, you know, but in all reality, it's going to be really bad. And when the Attorney General says all overpasses will be down, I think that's just the beginning. I won't be able, the Quartz Creek Bridge on Highway 26 are likely be down. The coast will be cut off, and when we talked to ODOT some time ago, they say 3 to 4 years before we'll be able to get through on some of these roads, and they'll choose a road or a couple of roads to get from the coast to the valley. But in all reality, the people who live at the coast will be cut off. And yeah, you can walk it. I see people riding bikes and hiking and stuff, and you could do it. It's going to take a while, but I certainly don't want to have to walk to Salem for us to get together. So I think this is a good first step in that sense. But I also think that we're going to have to give our people who, you know, there has to be people in charge. And likely the man is sitting right there. And maybe a small group in case, God forbid, something happens to you or you can't get to where you need to be. But I think we're going to have to not think in terms of party or, you know, personal likes or dislikes of people. When people are in those positions, need to be free to do what needs to be done to keep us whole and move us on. And I think we're, you know, we can look at what happened in Japan and, you know, the people who were in charge of recovery over there, and how they were, as prepared as they were shocked at how bad things were and still are. So, I mean, that's just a little bit of editorial comment, I guess. But I don't want to be gloom and doomy, but I really think that the majority of Oregon citizens don't understand what's going to happen. Hopefully it won't happen when we're all alive, but you know, it's likely it will, so we need to be prepared, and I think that this is part of that, so thank you.
Pass that off to the next generation to worry about?
No, not a bit, but they are being prepared. You brought that up. Kids in the schools, I mean, my whole school district in Seaside is discussing moving all their schools to higher ground, and our big problem right now, and I'm going to quit when I just mention it, I'll throw that grenade into the room. We could do it, but it's a very, very difficult to change the land use laws to expand the growth boundary so that the schools can. But we've got a timber company ready to sell us the property, and everything's ready to go except that process of getting within that urban growth boundary, whatever it is. It's a land use issue, and it's very difficult to achieve. So that's kind of a real hang-up right now. But I think you're going to see coastal communities getting more and more ready. The kids are all talking about it. They know what to do, where to go. But it's very serious and very depressing.
Isn't your district where they can't run to the highest ground and fast enough because they've timed some, their fastest runner in
a
your
really
district?
A really fast runner, and I thought, boy, that's bad news for me. Ground. I can barely walk down the hall here.
Representative Matthews.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Boone, your point's well made. I just would say it's not just being prepared for the ultimate disaster of a tsunami or anything else, but you might recall the winter storm that crippled us significantly. And Gresham reached out really early, proud of Mayor Shane Bemis for doing that. And we got the help of Oregon National Guard, and we appreciated the military responding. And that helped us kind of move about throughout the community, and they were helping us provide fire and emergency services, gaining access for police officers, do their job in law enforcement. So when I look at the bill that we just heard, and sorry before you gaveled out that I didn't get in there, I would just say, when you look at the governor being the chair of such committee, and then the adjutant general being the chairperson in his absence, and we're talking about some pretty high-powered people that are going to be pretty tied up as well. And I can tell you that they're going to expect a very effective committee that's going to respond quickly and be there in their need. I don't think anybody cares which party that's aligned with, but I would say that it would be the direction of this body, I would hope, that we'd put as few people as possible to make those big decisions so that we don't get delayed in providing service to the community, because that can happen sometimes in a room full of 20 to 25 people. You won't get a decision out of there. And quite honestly, people are going to need a decision maker. And I like to see the governor and adjutant general. I think both those individuals can make decisions. I just hope they have the time to be available to do that. And if not, then we should be thinking about the person that would be. and you said the man sitting in this room, if that wants to be Andrew Wilkinson, then I guess he can do it. But we might think about General Caldwell as well. Thank you.
I think this committee works. We should make all
He does great committee work.
That's exactly
right. We can get
right.
it done.
Well, and to General Caldwell's point as well, that in a large subduction event, this building might not even be here. I remember quite well back in the late 90s when we had just a 5.7 little shaker, and that is little compared to what we may be getting. The rotunda was roped off in this building because we were concerned that the gold man was going down to the basement. So even that little shake rendered this building, or at least parts of it, unususeful. So
put a pump on your head.
We get the real one, and it's going to make a big difference here in terms of our everyday lives. With that, anything further for the good of the order? Seeing none. Chana, anything coming up here that we may be interested in for the next meeting?
Our last meeting is this coming Wednesday, the 23rd, in which we will work these two bills, if we all agree. And we might have a possible informational hearing on the World War II Memorial.
You mean we only received two Senate bills?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
One of them similar to what we're doing.
Anything else?
Yep.
With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.